And then when Ollie's finished speaking, we've sung, we'll put a number up and you'll be able to text in those questions and we'll throw them at Ollie and think about them for a little while. But why don't the readers come and join me at the front?
Exodus 15:22. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying,
Moses, what shall we drink?
And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log. And he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying,
If you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God, and do that which is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer.
Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the 7th month, after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them,
O Moses, would that we have died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger.
Then the Lord said to Moses,
Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the 6th day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily.
So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel,
At evening you shall know that it was the Lord that brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we, that you grumble against us?
And Moses said,
When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord.
Then Moses said to Aaron,
Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, Come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.
And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked towards the wilderness. And behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses,
I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, At twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God.
In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine, flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another,
What is it?
For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them,
It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of persons that each of you has in his tent.
And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them,
Let no one leave any of it over till the morning.
But they did not listen to Moses.
Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank.
And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the 6th day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them,
"This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning."
So they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said,
"Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. For 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none."
On the seventh day,
some of the people went out to gather, but they found none.
And the Lord said to Moses,
"How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day."
So the people rested on the seventh day.
Well, good morning and welcome. Thanks, guys, for reading and bringing that passage to life for us. As always, on the inside of the sheet you were given on the way in, there's an outline of where we'll be going. So do open that up if that would help. We're going to be looking at what we've had read all the way down to the end of chapter 17 as well. So that's where we're going. But just imagine you bumped into one of these Israelites. What might you ask them? You might say, "Well, how is life in the wilderness? What do you think of the desert then? Do you like the snakes and the scorpions? Do you like the burning sand and the glaring heat? How is life in the wilderness?" Maybe you ask, "Have you met a camel yet?" Those are questions we might have asked the people of Israel in our reading as they wandered month after month in the wilderness. But it's not just the people of Israel who experience life in the wilderness. Christians also live life, as it were, in the desert. Being a follower of Jesus means that, like Israel, you have in the past been rescued. And being a follower of Jesus means that you have been promised a brilliant place ahead, a perfect world to come beyond this life. But now you live in the in-between, just like Israel, crossing the wilderness from Egypt to the promised land. And several times God makes this parallel between Israel crossing the desert and the life of a Christian. So don't turn to it now, but in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul summarizes all the things that Israel goes through, from crossing the Red Sea, which we heard about last week, to drinking the water that we hear about in this passage, to the things that happen later on in their journey. And then God says this. He says, "These things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." Paul says these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. And we've had several removal guys around the last couple of weeks to give us quotes for moving house. In the end, we did it ourselves yesterday with lots of help from some of you lovely people. But one guy who came to look at our stuff, we got talking about what I did, and I asked him if he'd read the Bible. And he said, "Yeah, I've read some of it, but I just don't understand what it means or what it's got to do with me." And lots of people say that, don't they? Including many Christians even, especially about the Old Testament. But God says that this was written for our instruction. That Israel are an example for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. So they're not an example to copy, but an example to learn from. And our passage this morning contains four episodes, as it were. We'll take the first three together under point one, and then we'll look at the fourth in point two. And if you remember back to last week's passage, the first word of point one, maybe a bit of a shock, because point one there, grumbling. That is the total opposite of last week's passage, which was all about celebration. So just glance back over the page. Chapter 14, God won and a victory of epic proportions. It was such an awesome triumph that God didn't just give us what happened in chapter 14, but he gave us chapter 15 and the songs that they sang to celebrate his victory. If you remember, Israel thought they were going to die. They were trapped between the armies of Pharaoh and the sea. But God made a path through the sea to safety and then brought it down on their enemies. And so there was serious celebration. Nothing like the kind of half-hearted pretense of victory that we saw from some politicians on Friday. Just look at chapter 15, verse 20. We didn't get many of this on Friday morning, did we? Tambourines and dancing. And verse 21, Miriam sang, "Sing to the Lord." There was serious celebration. But then look at verse 22. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. So just imagine the scene. Israel are about 600,000 men, plus women and children. We're told we're meant to drink about 2 litres a day, I guess a lot more in the deserts. So this is a vast multitude needing a lot of water. And by day three, I guess the water they brought with them is running low. But then they find water, don't they? Verse 23. But then disaster. The water is bitter. They can't drink it. Just imagine how gutting that would be. And so verse 24 is sort of understandable. The people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" I mean, it's sort of a fair question, isn't it? Life in the wilderness is tough. We found water, but it's undrinkable. So Moses, what are we going to do? But point one there, these episodes aren't just about Israel's grumbling. But also, point one, we see God's provision. So verse 25, Moses cries to God, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. So whether he used something in the wood or did it some other way, God's intervention is what changes everything. They grumble to Moses, and Moses kind of passes the buck, grumbles to God, or asks God the question. But when God speaks, these million or so men and women needing 2 million or more litres of water a day have what they need. And the water wasn't just okay, but look at verse 25. It became sweet. Israel grumbles, God provides. So far, so good, we might think. But verse 25 continues. Look down. There the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and he tested them, saying, "If you diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in his eyes and give ear to his commands and keep all his statutes, I'll put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord, your healer." So God says, okay, look, you've seen what I did to Egypt. You've seen what happens when people don't listen to my voice and rebel against me. You've seen the diseases I put on Egypt, the plagues. But as you're my people, you need to respond differently. Verse 26, God says, "Listen to my voice and do what I command. I freed you from serving Pharaoh and his voice and his commands. Now you're mine, and so serve me. And if you do," God says, "I can give you all that you need. For," end of verse 26, "I am the Lord, your healer. When you're thirsty, I'll satisfy you." And not just making bitter water sweet, but verse 27, look at that. He gives them 12 springs of water. A place so rich, there are 70 palm trees. God says, look, I've shown you so far in Exodus that I'm the ruler of this world. I make things go one way or the other. In the first plague, you saw me turn water into blood. I can take good water and make it undrinkable. And you've seen here, I can take undrinkable water and make it good. God has the power to be against you or to be for you. And so surely, as verse 26 says, listen to my voice and obey my commands. And so as this first episode draws to a close, how are you feeling? Do you think this is good news or bad news? God's provision is good, isn't it? Abundantly good. And God is inviting Israel to be with him, not against him. And to have the Lord as your healer, not your enemy. And given what they've seen, surely it is a no-brainer. But if you're feeling a little uneasy for Israel, then you may be right. Not just because of what happens next, but because this isn't the first time, is it, that they've seen who God is really clearly. And this isn't the first time that they've responded badly. Remember back in chapter 5 when Moses first told Pharaoh that they had to leave. Pharaoh just made their lives worse and Israel grumbled. But maybe fair enough, they'd not yet seen what God could do. But it was harder to give Israel the benefit of the doubt last week in chapter 14, wasn't it, at the Red Sea, when they cried out to Moses as the armies of Egypt approached and they said, "Why have you brought us to die in the wilderness?" Not believing that God had promised to rescue them. And so maybe actually verse 24, their question, isn't as fair a question as you might think at first. Especially think about it, they're concerned about the lack of water. They've spent the whole last chapter, just 3 days before, celebrating that their God has sovereign control over the water. So against that background, how do we feel hearing verse 26? God says, if you listen and obey, you'll enjoy healing rather than disease. Is that good news or bad news? Well, God's made things pretty clear now, hasn't he? So maybe that's just what Israel needed. But if that's what we were hoping, chapter 16 is a sad chapter. Because it's very much, as I've put on your sheet, take two. The same things happen. Starting again with grumbling. So verse 1, chapter 16. This is now the 15th day of the second month. So we're 6 weeks into their journey in the wilderness. Maybe they're getting a bit bored and tired of the desert. And now the shortage of food is getting to them. Because verse 2, if you look down, the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And they say, verse 3, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So not only do they grumble again, but their grumbling has reached new depths. In chapter 15, we were just told that the people grumbled. But look at verse 2. It's the whole congregation of the people of Israel, every one of them. In chapter 15, they just asked what they could drink. But now look at verse 3. They wish they had died under God's judgment in the plagues rather than being rescued by him. Isn't that staggering? Their memory of Egypt is appalling. Because we know that their life as oppressed slaves under genocide was not good. Can you see what an insult to God verse 3 is? They're throwing everything he's done for them back in his face. As I said, we moved house yesterday, which makes things a bit more tricky now in this kind of limbo period until we get sorted out. Everything's packed away and kind of strewn across the place. Just imagine that we got so fed up with unpacking and trying to find things that I said to all our kind helpers who'd given their time to help us, I wish you'd never come. I wish we were still back in our old flat and everything was just where it should have been. We'd know where things were. It'd be nonsense on the one hand, and it would be insulting to wish they hadn't bothered. And after what God said back in chapter 15, verse 26, that if Israel do what is right, God will put none of his diseases on them, then surely now we're fearing the worst. But verse 4 just repeats the tension. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. God is patient, isn't he? He's giving them another chance. And verse 6 shows what else he's giving them.
At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord. So God's not just given them another chance, but he's given them even more evidence, more reason to respond the right way and listen and believe. And God does just what he says. So verse 13, in the evening, quail, that's like a small bird, came up and covered the camp. And then verse 14, and when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing. And middle of verse 15, Moses said to them, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. And then end of verse 18, look down. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. Israel had claimed that they had meat in Egypt. God gives them meat on a plate. Israel claimed that they ate bread to the full. God gives them bread to the full. And not just bread, but look at verse 31. I don't know if this sounds good to you. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste was like wafers made with honey. Now that is pretty special bread, isn't it? Israel insult God, and he responds with great blessing. They claim that God has made things worse, and he gives them everything they want. God is good. God is immensely kind and patient and gracious to people who do not deserve it. I wonder if that's how you think of God. Particularly if you're here and you're not a Christian. Is this the God that you think of when you think of God, whether you believe in him or not? Or do you have lots of people do? Some idea of a stingy God who's trying to catch people out, trying to give people as little as possible. No, God is generous and kind and good. In the second episode, just as in the first, Israel grumble and God provides. But then again, just as in the first section, God demands obedience from Israel. Look again at verse 4. God will rain bread and the people, verse 4, shall go out and gather a day's portion every day. And verse 19, if you look across, Moses passes this on. Moses said, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. So God's voice has been heard, his command has been given, and notice that the way he does this means that they have to trust him. He'll give them each day just what they need that day. They can't hoard it, they can't become self-sufficient, they need to trust that God will give it again tomorrow. But what does Israel do? Verse 20. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Or God gives another command in verse 5. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they should bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. And again, Moses passes on the message, verse 26. For 6 days you shall gather, but on the seventh day there will be none. So remember that every other day of the week it doesn't keep. So keeping some for the seventh day, again, makes them trust God for tomorrow, that it won't go off, that they'll have food. But again, what did Israel do? Look at verse 27. On the sixth day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? And did you notice that they don't do the two specific things that God asked for? Look back to chapter 15, verse 26. They must listen to what God says and must keep his commands. But chapter 16, verse 20, they did not listen to Moses, who is passing on what God says. And verse 26, they refused to keep his commands. So again, episode 2. Is this good news or bad news? Well, again, of course, God's provision is immense. His patience is shining through like a light in a dark place. And verse 35, if you look down, his patience and kindness went on like this for 40 years. Then look at verse 32, where God commands them. to keep some manna forever. So they always remember God's kindness to them. But the better God looks, the worse Israel look. And the worse Israel look, the more the unease mounts. What is going to happen to them? Because just as the previous episode referenced God's plagues on Egypt, so in this episode too, we're reminded, aren't we, that God is king of creation. That he has power to be against you or for you. Just as he rained hail on Egypt, which destroyed their foods, so here he rains bread on Israel to provide. Or just as back in chapter 8 he made locusts come up and cover Egypt and destroy their crops, now God makes quails come up and cover Israel's camp. God can use his power either way. The same power that saves people crushes his enemies. The power that plagued Egypt could just as easily plague Israel. Which is a scary thought, isn't it? Because we're seeing that actually there's no big difference between Israel and Pharaoh. Just think about it. They both heard the word of God. They both saw demonstrations of his power, and they both refused to listen or do what he said. How long, we're starting to wonder, can Israel go on like this? Which takes us to the third section and take three. Because again, the same things happen. Again, they grumble. Look at chapter 17 and the end of verse 1. Israel camp at Rephidim, but there's no water for the people to drink. But we think that's okay. We know what happens at this point. No. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses. Again, think about it. Just weeks earlier, they celebrated God's control over the waters. Then God provided as easily as he wanted. Then he called them to listen to his voice and obey him. And he gave them proof again of who he is. And yet again, they refused to listen or obey. But now, verse 2, they test God. And the end of verse 7 of chapter 17 shows what this means. Look at the end of verse 7. They said, "Is the Lord among us or not?" They're not even sure if God is with them after everything they've seen. In other words, they're saying, look, if we're really going to believe that God is with us, if we're going to believe in him, he's got to do what we demand of him. And isn't that so similar to what many people say today? I'm going to ignore everything he's done to show me who he is. I'm going to set my agenda. And so as God begins to respond, verse 5, what are we expecting? The Lord said to Moses, well, if we remember chapter 15, verse 26, aren't we expecting the plagues God sent to Egypt to fall on Israel? Wouldn't that be right and fair? But again, we see God's patience. Verse 5, as again he provides. Moses takes the staff, verse 5. Take it in your hand and go. Verse 6, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb. You shall strike the rock and water shall come out of it. And the people will drink. God gives water to his people again. God provides. And so again, by the end of episode 3, what are we thinking? Is this good news or bad news? Israel just don't get it, do they? They will not listen to God or do what he says. They test him. They don't believe he's even with them. Yet God keeps on patiently, kindly, graciously providing. And so maybe we're beginning to wonder whether God actually means what he said in chapter 15, verse 26. I mean, Israel haven't listened to his voice. They haven't done what's right. They haven't kept his commands. Can this go on indefinitely? Is God really being patient, we may be thinking, or is he just being soft and kind of ineffective, as again, lots of people think he is? He'd like to do something, but he just can't manage it. Well, this is where our fourth section comes in. And point 2, and you can see how brilliantly God's put these chapters together for us, as this last section answers those questions. As we see, point 2 on your sheet, that God defeats those who oppose him. Look at chapter 17 and verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And that is awful, isn't it? Just think about what Amalek or the Amalekites are doing. I remember Israel, they're like a nation of refugees. They fled Egypt. They're at their most vulnerable. They've been struggling their way across the wilderness. They've just tasted freedom. God's plans and promises are just beginning to be fulfilled. And at that moment, Amalek strikes, trying to kill or enslave them, or send them back to Egypt, reversing what God has done. It's an awful thing they do. And at first glance, this episode is pretty simple, isn't it? Look at verse 13 at the end. And Joshua overwhelmed the Amalek and his people with the swords. Maybe we think that's familiar. We've seen that already, haven't we? Enemies come along and God defeats them. Once again, God gets his people through. And we can all go home pretty cheery. But as I've been preparing this and trying to see what God is saying in this particular bit of the passage, I don't think that it is just another story showing that God will bring victories to his people to encourage us positively to keep on trusting him. Like last week's passage and the Red Sea was. Because for one thing, we've just had that, haven't we, in the Red Sea. And compared to the Red Sea, this is a much less impressive victory. So look at verse 9. Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. So remember at the Red Sea, Israel did nothing. God did everything for them. Now they have to go and fight. And this battle isn't as clear cut as the Red Sea. Look at verse 11. Just glance back. Tomorrow I'll stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. And verse 11, whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. Sometimes Israel are winning. Sometimes the Amalekites are winning. So if it was just there to show us God's power to protect his people, come what may, it wouldn't actually do it that well. Because it kind of goes one way and then the other. And there's a few odd details here, aren't there? We didn't read it, but let me just show you. Verse 11, we had this business about Moses holding his hand and lowering his hands. Verse 12, and he struggles to keep his hands in the air. And they get a stone and he sits on it and then people hold up his hands in the air. And then look at verse 14. That's a slightly random niche detail, it would seem. God promises, write this as a memorial in a book, recite it, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. What is going on then in this last episode? Well, if after the first three episodes, God's continued kindness and patience maybe left us asking whether God really meant what he said, this last section says, yes, he does, clearly. God meant every word of it. We see that when people oppose him and his plans and reject him, then a time will come when he will carry out the judgment that he said he will. Amalek proposes God's rule. And so verse 14, God says, enough is enough. He will blot them out from the earth. And so as well as being, there's some encouragement here, it's also a big warning, isn't it, to Israel? Not just about what God says about Amalek, but look at verse 10. Israel are down in the valley, fighting away. But what they do seems to make no difference. Because verse 11, the whole battle stands or falls by whether Moses raises or lowers his hands. Which is to say that everything stands or falls by what God is doing. Now that's what the hand raising represents. Look at verse 15. Moses gives God the credit for the victory. He builds an altar and calls the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. Or in other words, when God was fighting for us, we were undefeatable. But when we were fighting alone, we were beaten. It's a warning, if you like, a wake up to Israel. When God is for you, all is good. We've seen that. But when God is against you, he will, as he promised to Israel, back in chapter 15, verse 26, he'll bring the plagues of Egypt on them if they continue to disobey him and refuse to listen to him. This last episode, with this kind of to and fro battle, leaves us on a knife edge. Which way is it going to go? God has genuinely shown it could go either way. On the one hand, their relationship with God is amazing. He is powerful and generous and good and kind and patient. But on the other hand, their relationship with God is edgy and precarious and under threat, it would seem, because they refuse to listen to him and they reject his rule, just as Pharaoh did. And that is where the story ends for this week. But just remember where we started. God says that if we're Christians, then we too are in a very similar position to Israel. We have been rescued, but we are heading for the promised land of the world to come. And God has given us this story as an example to us, as a warning to us, not to be like Israel. And so as we close, here are three big implications, which I'll just talk through briefly, but let's talk about them afterwards. First point there at the bottom, implications. Looking at Israel gives us the right expectations. Israel shows us that being partway through a rescue is a hard place to be, because we do not yet have what we will have, but we've left behind what we used to have. And so God's promises for the future can feel far off and distant and unreal, just as I'm sure they did for Israel. Our lives don't necessarily feel any better, and often they feel harder. And so we need the right expectations. I guess Israel maybe thought they'd be home and dry overnight. They thought they'd stroll out of Egypt one day and into the promised land the next day. And likewise, many people can think, and some people will tell you, that becoming a Christian means everything will go right here and now in this life. And some things may do, but many things won't. And we need to get our expectations right. And therefore, second, we need to hear the warning. Because just like Israel, if you're a Christian, you'll be tempted to look back and long for what you had before. Or look around you and long for what everyone else has. Because it's much more tangible, isn't it? And it's in your face than what God has promised you in future. We saw at the beginning of chapter 16 that Israel even wished that God hadn't saved them. And it's not impossible for us to think the same, is it? If I wasn't a Christian, you might think I'd be richer, perhaps. A life might be more comfortable. I could have the relationship I'd love to have. I'd be more acceptable to the world. I wouldn't feel out of place all the time. Just like Israel looked back to their apparent meat and bread in Egypt. Life in the wilderness is hard. And we must not be forgetful like Israel. And we need each other to do that, don't we? What Israel should have done is look back. Remember that God has always been faithful and always been powerful to keep every promise he's made. To remember these episodes, that God provides what they need. And that what is to come far outweighs the hard things about life in the wilderness. But we all know, don't we, that is easier said than done. And we know that we are forgetful like Israel. We know that although we know everything they knew, we still feel the pull of the world and the temptation to grumble. So why, we may think, is there any reason to think that things will be different for us? Israel's relationship with God was brilliant on the one hand, because God is generous and kind and powerful to provide. But it was also edgy and precarious and under threat, because they're slow to listen and slow to obey, just as we are. But if you're a Christian, we can, third implication there, have real confidence. Not because we're any different to Israel. We're very much in the danger of the same thing. But because of what we saw in that first reading, Israel's future depends on them listening to God and keeping his laws. And if we were to keep on reading, we would see that they keep on failing again and again. And as God said it would, it ends in disaster. But as we heard in that first reading, when Jesus is tempted in the wilderness and feels the hunger that Israel felt in the place where they were, he says to Satan, "I will not put God to the test." Isn't that incredible? Jesus listens perfectly to what God says and obeys perfectly. And so if we're trusting in Jesus, our relationship with God isn't always on a knife edge. Because in Jesus, God has provided not just food and water to keep us going for a few days, but everything we need. He has given us Jesus' perfect record. He has given us a relationship guaranteed by Jesus. Having rescued us, God can and will bring us to the perfect place he has promised. And so whatever hardship or temptation comes our way, let's hear the warning that Israel gives us and let's keep our confidence not in ourselves, but in Jesus. In a second, we're going to sing of the assurance we have in Jesus. Let's one of the bands go up so they're ready for that. But let me pray before we sing. Let's pray together. Our Father in heaven, we thank you so much that you've given us this book to instruct us, as an example to us, to warn us to not fall into the same kind of disobedience that Israel fell into, to not wish that we had never been rescued by you, to not turn back, to not harden our hearts against you. And we thank you, Father, so much that in Jesus you have given us something so much better than what they had, that you have given us his perfect obedience, that you have given us a guaranteed relationship with you through him. Lord, we pray that we would heed the warning and cling more closely to Jesus. And we pray this in his name. Amen.
We've got a few minutes to ask and get answers to some questions. So we're going to just pause for 1 minute or 2 minutes so you can text in those questions. The number to text is on the front of the notice sheet there. So text your question in. We'll have a short break for 2 or 3 minutes and then we'll get back together. Okay, let's come together there. Okay, got a few questions and a few more coming in. As ever, I doubt we'll have time to get to them all, but we'll try and get through as many as we possibly can. Someone asks a little bit about 1 Corinthians 10 and Paul's use of this passage. Do you want to get? I'll ask the question. You can work through as much of it as you feel you can. In what way is Christ the rock they drank water from? And in what way is the Red Sea parting Israel's baptism into Moses and perhaps the manna an image of the Lord's Supper? You probably can't do justice to all of those, but give us a bit of a start on that.
Yeah, I definitely don't say thanks for that. I knew it was risky referencing 1 Corinthians. So there are the, what have we got? We've got the, so have a look at it later if you want.
Page 957, if you're still looking.
But so we're told verse, I'll just give you a second to find it. Page 957, 1 Corinthians 10. And it's a tricky passage, but it is a good passage because it is one of these places where Paul says, let's go through everything Israel went through. These are warnings for us. This is the parallel between them and us. It's worth saying, I think up front, hopefully this came across, but there are big similarities, but there are also big differences. So continuity with them. Discontinuity as well, so we're not in exactly the same place, obviously. But look at verse 4. This is bizarre when you first read it. They all drank from the same spiritual drink, okay? For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. I mean, what does that mean? Some people might think Jesus was somehow the rock. I think it's a helpful parallel to think of. It's another place this passage, Exodus, is picked up. So when Jesus talks about in John 6 about being the living bread that comes down from heaven. He's using what happened to Israel in the wilderness as an example to teach about what he is. So just as God provided physical life to them through the bread, he is the spiritual life that God is providing. And I think the rock is probably being used in the same way here. So not that Jesus is literally the rock that produced the water, but what he does for us spiritually in giving us life is eternally, spiritually, is what God did for Israel in providing water. But there are possible ways. The baptisms of Moses, I've thought far less about. But I'll pass that over to Jamie because I know he's dying to answer questions. He's really sad that he didn't get many questions on his previous week. So
we're going to keep going. Someone asks, why do God's people in the Old Testament keep disobeying? Is it different for us now that we have God's Spirit?
Yeah, it is different. And that's one of the big differences between them and us. Lots of places that the Old Testament and New Testament tie together. But that's one big difference that God says now. So you may know there's a promise in the prophet Jeremiah and picked up in Hebrews where God says, I'm going to make a new covenant. It's not going to be like that covenant. And he used the picture of, I'm going to, instead of giving you commands external to you, I'm going to write my law on your heart. And so that difference that God is now changing us from the inside by his Spirit. So he's given us new hearts that want to obey him, new desires. But don't let that take away the warning of the same danger. So God says there is a difference, big difference, significant difference that gives us confidence. But it's not because we're any better than Israel. It's not because we're in any less danger of hardening our hearts, drifting away, being tempted by the world. But yeah, that is a big difference.
So this follows up on that. How does Israel's risk of coming back under the plagues for disobedience play out for the Christian? Has this changed or does this continue?
Yeah, you know, that has changed. So again, another big difference. Again, we've got to be careful we don't use one thing that God says to negate something else he says. So another good place to look at later would be Hebrews chapter 3 and 4. That's another place where the comparison is made really clearly. And really strongly, that passage says, watch out. If you harden your heart and turn away, then you're in very great danger. But we don't operate under the same covenant that Israel operated under. We'll think more about this as we go through Exodus. They're really clearly given, as we saw this today, God says, if you obey me, keep these laws, then I'll bless you, you'll be my people, I'll heal you, as we had in this passage. If you disobey, then you'll face my curses. For us, that doesn't depend on our obedience to that. That depends on Jesus' obedience in our place. So that's why the passage in Luke is so amazing, so brilliant to see that Jesus obeys perfectly. And so we've seen this in Romans, we've seen this other places. We are now treated as if we're inside Jesus. So God looks at us, and that perfect obedience is counted to us. So we don't have a good day, and God says, brilliant, I'm going to bless you today, and have a bad day, and God says, I'm going to curse you today. God looks at us and says, you're in Jesus. I love you. You're safe. You're treasured. So the warning is not, is though then that we walk away from Jesus. We stop trusting him. And that is a real warning that God gives.
So we've touched on it already, really, but the big difference between us and them is the circumcised heart that is promised in the new covenant. That's Israel's big problem. Their hearts just turn away from God again and again. And when you get to the end of the Old Testament, you discover that's been the big problem all along. God's been gracious to them as he's come towards them. But now we have the new heart and the promises that God makes. In fact, we'll see one of them this evening in 1 Peter. Peter says in chapter 1, you are being kept. So God has us in the palm of his hand. And yet he's not afraid to warn us. One of the ways he will keep us is by these warnings. We mustn't harden our hearts to what he's saying. People ask, there's more great questions. Someone says, how can we ask God to provide without grumbling?
Great, really great question. Because, this isn't to say that when things are hard, God doesn't care, God isn't interested. Hopefully we've seen today, God is, you know, he's generous. He loves to provide. But it does mean that our acceptance of God doesn't depend on whether he gives us good days or bad days or hard times or easy times. And that was Israel's problem. They said, as long as you do what we say, we'll go with you. So I think it looks like, asking for God to provide, but saying, I'm going to trust you, I'm going to stick with you, whether you do choose to give me this particular thing or not, or solve this particular situation or not. One of the things that God is doing through this process is, as he does for Israel, he is giving them opportunities to learn to trust him. That's the thing with the manna. He's saying, he could have given them, I guess he could have just given them an endless supply they could always go to, but he says, I'm going to give you every day. And so God does use our circumstances, hard times, challenges. Sometimes he resolves them, sometimes he doesn't, but they're always for our good, and response is to trust him, but not to think that he doesn't want us to ask or that he may not answer.
And it's worth noting that the way the New Testament takes this story, the great thing about being in Jesus Christ, as Ollie talked about, is in a sense we can ask for anything. The New Testament says, cast your anxieties onto him because you matter to him. He cares for you. So there's nothing we can't bring before the Lord, anything and everything. But the way the New Testament takes this story is to say it's the fulfillment of the bread from heaven in the Gospels is Jesus Christ, of course, and everything that he's given for us. And the promised land that we're heading to is the new creation. And so the sort of cast iron thing we can always ask for, that we'll always get, is forgiveness of sins and the promise of a new creation. And because we've got a God who's abundantly generous along the way, he will give us lots of other things to keep us going, some material, some spiritual. But the one thing we can always be sure of, even if we don't get the material things we long for, is that he's with us and for us and at work in all our circumstances to get us to that place, the true promised land, the new creation. And that's the sort of underpinning of the Christian life. That means when circumstances aren't going our way and we're not getting even the things we're asking for in this life, that hasn't changed God's disposition towards us. Christians, he always wants to give that ultimate good thing.
Just say one more thing. I think that's where this passage, thinking about us as in the wilderness, should change our agenda. So I think the reason we find it hard is because we think my goal is to live a happy, easy life like everyone else and be comfortable. But actually, if we think ourselves as halfway through the rescue, our goal is to get to the end. Actually, sometimes it means that things that are hard will actually help us get to the end better than if things were always easy and we were more content and happy here.
Okay, last question, because the children are going to be bouncing off the walls. Someone asks, can you just clarify how we obey the commands and statutes of God? We know we trust in Jesus, but how do we obey God's expectations of us? He gives plenty of instruction along the way. How does that dynamic work?
Big question. I think As we've already said, the supreme command, or if you like, the most important thing that God says to us is he's using these kind of stories to show us that we cannot obey all his commands ourselves. We need Jesus to do that for us. Obedience to what God says to us now looks like trusting in Jesus. That's the supreme thing. But once we have that obedience, we have that righteousness given to us, then we're free to, as we said, we have new desires. We now want to obey him. But that's not done out of fear of, oh, if I get one thing wrong, maybe I'll be gone forever. But as we'll see in 1 Peter, it's because we have a new relationship. We have a Father who loves us. We have a hope ahead of us. That changes who we are. But that's not done because we're worried about stepping out of line and God sending plagues on us. That's because we have that secure, that future, and therefore we want to live it out.
Great. Thank you very much. Hey, look, we need to stop there. But let that be the beginning of the conversation. As ever, these question times aren't meant to sort of stop now. If you had a question or that answer started a train of thought, pick it up with the person sitting next to you. Tea and coffee are served outside. Why don't I just close again with the words that we began our service with, Psalm 103. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Amen.